You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. Joining me today on the show is Nathan Gilmore, English teacher at North Gwinnett High School. Nathan, how are you doing this morning?
Doing well. By the time our listeners hear this, I will be in day two of the interminable meetings that characterize the, in this case, 7 business days before the school year starts. So, listeners, if you can spare a prayer for me, pray for me in those endless meetings.
Now, you that's assuming that you do not decide to drop out for the good of the country shortly into those meetings or halfway into those
meetings.
If God
Almighty actually tells me to drop out of high school teaching, then obviously I'll do so and, probably announce it on X.
Right. Would it require everyone around you saying, hey, Nathan, it's time? Would you just decide to do it?
You know, usually it's just my students that say it's probably about time that you get out of this.
That's fair. Students do tend to say that.
Do they ever?
It's been a while since I've read a. I mean, basically, haven't read a student review since I got tenured. I do awkwardly force them all to give me reviews face to face. So we spend the last day of class going around the room, and I try to reward the ones that give negative reviews to encourage them to actually tell me what they think. So far, I've not yet gotten "you need to quit," but I'm sure that's
all
coming.
Right.
I had
about a 3-semester span between, you still don't know what you're doing and you're too old to do this. So, it's kind of like my theory about email, that there was a 182-day span between most of the faculty is so old that they don't get email. And most of the faculty is so young that they're too hip for email.
Yeah.
And those were 182 happy days for me because I like email.
it's certainly easier than a lot of the other stuff. It's easier to ignore, if nothing else.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Well, Nathan, what's going on around the network?
Well, since the last time we recorded 3 days ago, there'll be a week's gap between episodes. But, the interview that I mentioned last time with Catherine Dell will have dropped, which, if you have had any Old Testament studies coursework, it's a fairly technical discussion that we have. But I think it's a rewarding one. Other than that, we're still kind of waiting for more episodes to drop. The network continues to soldier on and, I think we're still giving the internet some good content.
Well, some content anyway. It just depends on on which we're talking about.
Yes, indeed.
So today, this is an episode you pitched on the Electoral College, on a hypothetical about the Electoral College. So why don't you dig into your scenario here?
Yeah. So this is the second of 3 What If episodes, and as Coyle said, I pitched to him, an idea for a trio of episodes. Where we talk about scenarios that often get brought up in political conversations. A little while ago, we did an episode on what if the 2 major political parties did away with public primaries and went back to convention selection of candidates.
As the Democrats are going to be doing, right?
As it turns out, I think the DNC listens to our show, Coyle. And they said, you know what? That sounds awesome. We should do that.
I hope they do because they deserve it.
if anyone deserves that kind of cruel and unusual punishment, it's the bigwigs at the DNC.
Oh, man.
This is our second one. This one, is one that I started hearing a lot long about 2000. It has come in waves and it has ebbed over the years since then. But it is, what if a constitutional amendment abolished the Electoral College? So, Coyle, this one is a little bit different from public primaries because primaries are party matters. They're not in the Constitution.
Yeah.
This one decidedly is. And the process of electing electors got changed pretty soon by the 12th Amendment. So, I mean, talk us through the early changes in that process. I mean, from the ratification of the Constitution to the 12th Amendment, how did the process of selecting a president work? What did the 12th Amendment change? And, you know, what have we been dealing with since the 12th Amendment?
Yeah, so I think kind of a couple of things to keep in mind whenever we're thinking about the Electoral College. So this is big picture stuff, and then I'll zoom in on your question. One is that it has always been controversial. So you can go back and read the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers, and they go back and forth on whether the Electoral College is a good idea. It's sort of a hodgepodge of ideas that Madison pulled from Polish government of all places, and then the Holy Roman Empire. So the electors would meet and elect a Holy Roman Emperor. Poland had something similar. Now you know everything I know about Polish government in the 1700s. But
there you go.
So they're stealing this from various places. The Anti-Federalists, of course, said this is terrible because they thought the Constitution was terrible. And they especially thought it would end up being an aristocratic cabal, just taking over the government and running everything. That is basically what Hamilton said he wanted. That was the goal. They properly identified what his intention was. The original purpose was that each state was supposed to select the best and brightest, the most virtuous individuals in the state. They would meet together as an electoral college. They would look out over the landscape of the nation, and then they would pick the best and brightest, the most virtuous person to be president.
So let me pause just a second, Coyle. I mean, was there any glance cast on the election of popes? Because, I mean, this sounds like...
I don't know.
It sounds like an idealized version, I'll put it that way, of the election of a pontiff.
I don't remember that being mentioned in the Federalist Papers. It might be, but I don't remember it. It would be a little surprising if they mentioned it, even if they knew about it, right? I mean, that's not their audience. There are Roman Catholics in the country, but not many of them. I think probably the biggest name Roman Catholic at this point is Charles Carroll, and he's obviously not a big name.
There's not a whole lot of Polish electors either, but, you know.
No.
Like I said, you know, they seem to be pulling from an eclectic so I just wondered if that was part of the stew.
I don't remember.
Boy, I'm mixing metaphors.
I don't remember. but very, very similar, right, in what the intent is. It's you're supposed to pick sort of the best. It worked that way exactly one time, right? They picked George Washington universal acclaim. That was the time it worked fairly well. Washington's second election was a little more contentious, and then Adams was functionally picked as a kind of a third option. And then by 1800, the whole thing has basically fallen apart with the rise of political parties. States basically yield their responsibility to choose virtuous individuals becomes a partisan election, and they start picking just partisan hacks to be electors. And it's been that way ever since 1800. In 1800, the sort of main functional issue that the Electoral College runs into, and this leads to the 12th Amendment. Prior to the 12th Amendment, the presidency goes to whoever gets the most votes, and the vice presidency goes to whoever gets the second most votes, the runner-up, which is fine as long as there are no political parties or as long as the top two are in the same party. So they go through and put in the 12th Amendment that says now electors choose basically a president and vice president together. It's marginally more involved than that, but that's the big thing. It keeps the ticket unified. You keep the two together. The election of 1800 is a shambles for other reasons as well. The Electoral College does not pick a president. It has to go to the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives proceeds to tie when they vote. You need a majority, and no one gets a majority. They have to vote something like 36 times before Hamilton famously steps in and says, look, both these guys are awful, but I hate Thomas Jefferson slightly less than I hate Aaron Burr, so why don't we go with Jefferson as president? So since then, the Electoral College has continued to be controversial, right? It's continued to be seen in the minds of the American people as inherently undemocratic, which to be fair, it is. It is intentionally empowering states as entities that contribute to the election of the president. So it's overpowering smaller states for the purpose of them not being swamped by just sheer numbers in the larger states. That is the stated intention of the Electoral College, in addition to supposing to be virtuous and picking the most virtuous person. That hasn't worked for 200 years. The overrepresentation of states that would otherwise be underrepresented, that continues to work just fine. There's something else I was going to throw in there. Oh, the other thing to remember, kind of big picture thing, and we hear this every 4 years, whenever there's an election, we hear someone talking about how terrible it is that we don't directly elect our president, and especially in election years like 2000, like 2016, where there's a disconnect between the popular vote and the Electoral College. One thing to keep in mind is that it's actually incredibly uncommon around the world for people to directly elect their executives. I'm not an international affairs guy, so listeners, if I'm off on this, you can speak in and correct me. But I think of the major first world Western nations, I think France is the only one that directly elects an executive. I mean, if you're English, you will never vote for the prime minister, unless you happen to live in his district. Like if he's your MP, then you'll vote for him as your MP, but you'll never directly vote for the prime minister. I think the German chancellor works the same way. You don't vote directly for executives in most nations.
Right. Pretty much any parliamentary system is going to work that way. Right.
So Brazil directly elects their president. So I guess if we aspire to be like Brazil, getting rid of the Electoral College might be a way to move in that direction. But it's our system is unique. I'm not aware of other nations that use something like this. They probably exist. There's 200 countries in the world, but it is unique. But we actually have a little more say over who the president is than most other people in Western nations.
Right. I have to ask this question for my own curiosity as much as to anticipate listener objections. When people call for the abolition of the Electoral College, they don't want to go home, so they often go big. So I've heard the Electoral College called anti-democratic, which we've already addressed, sure, pro-slavery, and all kinds of variations of the two. So how much of that pro-slavery criticism is warranted? How much misses the point? And how much of it ignores historical facts?
I mean, obviously, it's no longer warranted since, you know, the passage of the 13th Amendment. So it's kind of an irrelevant argument since then.
Right, kind of a genetic fallacy deal.
Yeah, it certainly gave slave states more of a voice in the elections than they would have had, because they were the smaller states. Now that would not necessarily have been the case when this was being ratified, because Virginia was the largest state at that point. It did give more representation to smaller states, which up until the 1860s meant the southern states. I would be a little surprised by someone who wanted to make that argument in the modern era, other than as a historical argument. Right. So yes, historically, that is one of the effects of the Electoral College. Certainly giving slave states more power was part of the compromises that they were cut. So in that sense, it's part of the intent. That hasn't really been a relevant argument for 150 years at this point.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, like I said, I mean, you know, there's something of the genetic fallacy there. There's also, I mean, some of the guilt by association rhetorical smear there, that, you know, if you win because of the Electoral College, you are in the same boat as slave owners 200 years ago.
Right. So there would be other things. So if we were living, you know, 60 years ago, people would say, well, it's empowering Jim Crow, right? Or pick your issue of choice that states now have control over. You say, well, this is really just empowering whatever this issue is, right? So there is something to that. I think that is probably more a reflection of the growth of the power and influence of the president than of the means of choosing the president. So that's you're not so much condemning the Electoral College as saying I'm not getting my way politically. It's harder for me to get my way politically, and of course we all make that claim sometimes.
You don't hate Mondays, you hate capitalism. All right, so my own sense of things is that nothing short of a coup or some other dissolution of the current constitutional order would actually abolish the Electoral College. I mean, for 2/3 of the states to ratify this kind of constitutional amendment, a whole bunch of people in North Dakota and Nebraska and Vermont and West Virginia would have to decide that they want the folks in New York City and San Francisco and Chicago and Los Angeles to have more say about their day-to-day lives than they currently have. But you're the political science professor, so you have a stronger grasp on the range of possibilities here. Is there in 2024 a conceivable path inside of our current system for direct plebiscites to choose presidents?
Yeah, so there's a movement right now that's going around the constitutional process. I forget exactly what it's called. It's something like the Interstate Electoral College Compact or something like that. It's basically an agreement between states to say that whoever wins the national popular vote, the states that have signed this agreement automatically give their electoral votes to that person, regardless mm-hmm. of how the people in their state voted. Theoretically, as soon as the number of states who have signed on to that hits 270 electoral votes, the Electoral College is now null and void, and it's the popular vote mm-hmm. all the way down. They don't have 270 votes yet, but they are getting close. I don't remember the exact number. It's something like 230 or 240. I mean, it's up there. Of course, as soon as California signs on, that's a chunk of them right there. New York and Illinois in, which I don't know if they've signed or not, but there are a handful of states, and you're all of a sudden very close to that. So if that works, that would not require the same sort of threshold as getting states on board with a constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that would hold up according to the Supreme Court. What would happen if someone would have won the Electoral College based on the electoral vote, how it should have gone based on state elections, versus someone who, under this system, if it ever gets if it's ever tried, wins under that, then you'd have a Supreme Court case, and I don't know what they'd say.
Okay, so I mean, what grounds would drive that Supreme Court case then? Would that be like a 14th Amendment kind of deal?
Or you'd say that states aren't allowed to subvert the Constitution. Like, there's a clear electoral college in the Constitution, okay. And states okay. are using their authority. Now, on the other hand, the Constitution is very clear that states are in charge of assigning electors. So it would be kind of one side of the Constitution versus another side. And I don't know.
Okay, that's it. Yeah, because I mean that's the argument that immediately occurs to me. But so you're saying that there would be some kind of an argument, whether the Supreme Court would find it compelling or not, yeah. that a state choosing to cede its authority would in fact take the authority away from the state.
Well, and the Supreme Court has been very inconsistent on this, so I don't know where they would land. And of course, who knows who will be on the Supreme Court by the time this all comes around, anyway. So
sure.
I don't know. I don't know what they would say. There are no real rules in the Constitution for how states have to pick electors. State legislatures have to do it, but beyond mm-hmm. that. They can, if they want to have, you know, trial by combat as the means of picking electors, they can do that. There's no restrictions on that, at least not as far as I'm aware. Beyond, again, sort of broad constitutional things, there are restrictions on who they can pick as president. Uh-huh. And there are some, I'd have to go back and look at it. Now that I say that, maybe some of the prohibitions on, you know, if you've been convicted of insurrection, maybe that applies to electors also. I don't remember.
Oh, no, that's interesting. Okay. Yeah, because like I said, I mean, I guess because, you know, I'd never considered the possibilities for, you know, the arguments against. I mean, it just seems to me that system that you narrated, and I can't think of the title of it either, would just simply fall into place, and that would be the way of things. But
which it probably would. That's probably what would happen. But I could see someone.
Okay, you're saying the court probably would say this is just an exercise of the states. Governing their collections.
Yeah, depending on the court. I mean, I don't know how you don't say that, but of course, the court is never really tied to the text of the Constitution, regardless of what they say otherwise. So, The court has done a lot of things that I look at it and say, I don't know where you get that other than you wanted to do it. So,
yeah, I gotcha. So, I mean, you know, and you know, just to say it one more time before I move on, I mean, you know, so some states are not by the process of amending the Constitution, but by working within the current constitutional framework, moving away from the authority of the Electoral College, even if not the existence of the Electoral College.
Which again is one of the concerns that some of the critics had in the early days. What do you do if California, Texas, and New York get together and say, hey, we're always going to cast our electoral ballots for the Democratic Party or the Republican Party.
Right.
And the Federalist basically said, you got to trust your states on that. Could happen.
Okay.
But at that point, you're saying that you have corrupt state governments, while you're also saying we think that state governments should be the final authority. So anti-federalists pick a lane here, right? Do you trust state governments or not?
That makes sense. Right. Okay. That's interesting. Because I had heard about that, but I had never connected it to this debate, because almost always the public rhetoric that I hear has to do with, you know, abolishing the Electoral College rather than simply dispensing with it otherwise.
Well, and that's the op-ed pieces, right? You can write an op-ed piece about abolishing the Electoral College and sell it to a newspaper and get a lot of traction out of it. A complex piece of legislation that involves multiple states signing an agreement with each other, you're not going to get that published in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, right? At least not easily, and not in a way that people are going to actually understand. I'm sure it's been written up in both of those, but
right. Well, yeah, and on the level of the political entertainment industry,
right,
I can see that. As far as activism, though,
right.
I mean, you know, how compared to the, and again, here's another place where I just don't have knowledge. Compared to the amount of resources and energy and attention people put into trying to abolish the Electoral College, and that might be zero. It might be purely an election year temper tantrum that people throw. You know, is there a substantial, you know, legislative lobbying movement trying to move towards dispensing with the authority of the Electoral College?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just not sure. Amendments to the Constitution are proposed all the time in Congress, but of course there's a lot of crackpots in Congress, so that doesn't necessarily mean anything. Most of them don't go anywhere, and I just don't know how far they've gone with any of those movements. I think there are amendments that you are likely to see seriously debated. Term limits on Congress is hands down the one that I think we're going to see most, because everyone's kind of in favor of that. But I don't know that issue specifically. I did just look up it's called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is the name of it.
Does that spell anything as an acronym?
No. It should.
Interesting. Usually if it's more than four letters, it spells some kind of word.
They named it poorly, I guess. It looks like they have 209 electoral votes that have agreed to this. Another 50 that are pending, and I'm not sure. That could mean either that they're still considering it, or it could mean that they are. They're often what legislatures will do is they'll say, well, as soon as there are enough states on board with this, then it goes into effect. As with the abortion laws, several states had laws on the books that said, as soon as the Supreme Court overturns abortion, this law goes into effect. This would be, I assume, is the same sort of thing. So there's about 50 votes. Which brings them up to 259, if we count that.
That's pretty close.
Votes. Yeah.
All right. No, I mean, that's a side of it. Like I said, I had heard of that, but I didn't know that many states had at least considered it as a serious possibility. So that's fascinating that, you know, something that I considered kind of a science fiction or political science fiction, whatever, possibility, you know, actually is closer in our actual world than I realized.
Yeah.
So. And honestly, I mean, that actually adds to my fascination with the next question. And this is the question I enjoy thinking about the most, because when progressives, and it's almost always progressives, lament the continued existence of the Electoral College, they almost always assume that the same number of people would show up on the same election day contests and vote for the same people. And I just think that's unimaginable, because any kind of competent national campaign would just run itself differently if, you know, individuals rather than states were picking presidents.
Yeah.
So if this constitutional amendment passed in 2025, my hunch is that the data people working for the big parties wouldn't be able to keep up with the crazy that would suddenly spring up as Orange County in California and Houston in Texas and Southern Illinois and all of those mid-sized cities all over the country. If they suddenly had votes that could actually swing an election, because, I mean, frankly, they haven't. You know, you have to wait for your state to become purple, as I've had to wait in Georgia. So say a little bit about that. I mean, you know, is this, I mean, the kind of math that we could do on a podcast episode, or is this something that rooms full of eggheads would be working on for months without sleeping if this change happened?
Oh, I mean, it could be done, right? It's in that sense, it's just polling, right? It's just asking people, and targeting your polls to where people are, maybe more broadly instead of narrowly within swing states. So yes. I mean that would just be a matter of using the data, and obviously, so this is one of the arguments that came up after the 2016 election. When mm-hmm. people said, well, Trump just won because he manipulated the Electoral College. And the response to that is, well, yeah, that's how you win, right? He only won this game because he made more, three-pointers than the other team did. Well, yes, it's not his fault they were focusing on free throws.
Or my favorite example, the Indianapolis Colts had more yards than the New Orleans Saints in Super Bowl 41. So
yeah.
I still maintain that the Colts won that Super Bowl.
Right. That's not how you win, right? It needs to be good yards, Nathan.
Yes.
So
the yards that count.
If it hadn't been the Electoral College that chose the president, uh-huh. presumably Trump, instead of, and this is one of the classic historical political blunders in the last month or so of the election season, Trump was in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania just nonstop, rallying all around those states. Hillary was primarily in Los Angeles, still doing the same thing, attending fundraisers and campaigning, but she was going to win California. She was running up the score in a place that she had already won. Trump was targeting places that no one really thought were swing states, but turned out that they were. So if it had been a popular vote instead of an Electoral College election, Trump might have still gone to those swing states because there are people there. But I think he would have spent a lot more time in New York and Houston and Miami and Los Angeles and a lot less time in the Rust Belt.
Right. Now, I mean, and that raises my next question. I mean, you know, would this mean that the apparatus for campaigning would change? Because, I mean, you know, like you just said, it is a classical political blunder to try to run up the score in Los Angeles when it's the, you know, Midwestern states that might flip, right? And, you know, I mean, the sense that I got back then, and you can tell me whether this is on target or whether it's completely wrong, is that, you know, I mean, Hillary had, you know, some very specific policy agendas in mind for her early administration. And, you know, being able to go in front of cameras and say, we had a historically lopsided, you know, popular vote win would give some momentum to that agenda. So, I mean, you know, again, would the suburbs become important in different ways in the wake of this? Or, you know, would it basically, you know, what would the change be? I can't even think of the possibilities.
Well, and here's where I'm not a campaign guy, so I don't know. My gut says that all campaigns would start to look a lot more like Bloomberg's campaign did. If you remember how Bloomberg was every banner ad you saw on every website you ever went to.
Right.
I think there would be a lot more.
This was, 2020?
Yeah. So his, it was like a month and a half campaign. It was a super short campaign. Sure. But it was also super intense because he spent all of the money on an online campaign. He did some traveling around and such too, but it was basically investing everything in online advertising. I'm assuming we would see a lot of that, just practically because that's what you can do when you're trying to target large numbers of people. I would assume that small rural states would never again see a presidential candidate. So why would you go to North Dakota? Because I mean maybe early in the campaign season to practice a little bit, but
right.
There just aren't enough people there for it to be worthwhile. Same thing with Alaska or Hawaii or Vermont or New Hampshire. You might in some of those places because, you know, Vermont is kind of close to Boston. So maybe you go to Boston and campaign and then on your way to New York City, you might swing through Vermont and say hi to people for a minute. But otherwise, you're not going to host rallies there. You're not going to spend time doing that. So there would be some of those sorts of changes. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if the calculus would be cities are where the people are, so focus everything there, or you say, yeah, I'm on the political side that's never going to win a city, so I'm going to campaign in the suburbs and the rural communities and just hope that I can get enough people to turn out that they override the number of voters in the cities. I don't know what the right answer is.
But then even cities, and there are exceptions to this, but I mean, I feel like I've seen polling numbers in cities that are closer to 60-40 than they are to 80-20. So, I mean, you know, it seems like those urban populations, I mean, would become less important really than
and now we're
broadly scattered.
Yeah, we're into the area. I just don't know what a genuine popular campaign look like across the whole country. You can't even say it would just look like a Senate campaign writ large, because of course Senate campaigns are tailored to the state they're in. So
yeah
I don't know.
Well, that's what I wonder. I mean, would there be a shift to something more like a parliamentary election, where, I mean, you wouldn't even see the candidate except maybe online, but, you know, and it wouldn't even be a state, you know, level politician, but, I mean, your most proximate urban politician would be kind of the face of whatever it is you're doing. And again, I realize all of this is science fiction, which is why I like it so much.
Right.
I love this kind of speculation. And, you know, whenever I ask my friends who are history professors these kinds of science fiction questions, they always just shake their heads and they say, that's not what I do. And I'm like, just try it. It's fun.
You should reach out to Newt Gingrich. He's got some alternative historical fiction novels that he co-wrote. His name is on them. I can't imagine he actually wrote them. But he does that sort of thing. So.
There you go.
I'm with you in that it's fun, but I don't know. Like, I genuinely don't know what the answer is.
I gotcha. And just to keep pressing the I don't know questions, but I mean, it also seems to me that the concentration of political gravity has tended to, you know, increase the extremes, increase the polarization. I mean, you know, would something like this, you know, because it had to appeal to everybody all of a sudden and not just the people in the suburbs of Cincinnati, you know, would this moderate things, do you think, or would it, you know, empower the extremes because, you know, all of a sudden those, you know, I'm not going to name a state because I do value my online safety, but, you know, those people who live in places that right now get ignored by politicians, that's vague enough, I hope. Yeah. Would suddenly have as much sway as, you know, someone in the suburbs of Atlanta does right now.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, you don't need to sway everyone, even in a popular system. You just need to sway one more person than the other side. And would that mean polarization or would that mean moderation? That's going to depend almost entirely on your citizen body, and not just the citizen body in purple states, but the whole citizen body. So.
Right.
Maybe a short-term moderation and a long-term polarization everywhere. But again, I don't know. I always kind of default to Plato and say the more democratic something is, the worse it's going to be in the long term. But I think that's generally a good principle, but what would that look like in practice? Yeah, no idea. The closest analog we've got is when they turned when they started popularly electing senators. I'm sure I've shared this story on the air before, and if I haven't, then shame on me because it's such a good one. The first election of senators was immediately massively corrupted. Now the old way of doing it had its corruptions as well. The senator from Montana, a guy named William Clark, one of the less famous robber barons, made his millions in copper in Montana, bribed the state legislature to get himself appointed to the Senate. While he was in the Senate, he voted to change to add in the 17th Amendment. So now senators are elected. And also, while he was in the Senate, it came out that he had bribed his way into the Senate. The news broke the story, and the Senate expelled him. So he went back to Montana and ran a campaign and got himself elected back into the Senate. So, you know, that's. Did it make anything better to have it directly elected? Well, not necessarily. My other one more historical story, because this is such
go
a good
ahead
one.
Go ahead.
In Nebraska, the local political party chair the state chair of, which I don't remember if it was Republican or Democrat, it doesn't matter, right, decided that he didn't like the current senator who was running for re-election for the first time. This is the first time they'd ever had a Senate election. So he had been appointed by the state legislature. Now he's running for election. So this local party boss finds a grocer, a guy who owns a grocery store with the same name, and puts him on the ballot. So that when people go to vote in the primary, there are two identical names on the ballot, and then this third name. And the theory is, well, the third name is the one who's going to win because the other two are going to split the vote. Well, this becomes this whole national scandal. News breaks that this is what had happened. Both the party boss and the grocer end up in prison, and the guy wins his reelection. So it's kind of a happy ending. But again, immediate corruption is the result of this introducing Democratic politics into it. Again, it's not that it wasn't corrupt before that. It's just a different kind of corruption in play.
Right. Well, I mean, another follow-up question I have, I mean, you know, my instincts tell me that, you know, this would improve voter turnout because, I mean, I just think of all the folks who live in the college towns in red states, all the folks who live in the suburbs of blue states, who have known their entire lives that, you know, they're high school civics teacher wants them to show up and vote, but really their showing up and vote isn't going to change anything.
Right.
If all of a sudden they're going to actually conceivably move the needle one direction or the other, does that increase? I mean, because it increases agency, does it increase turnout, do you think?
Again, I don't know. There are some parallels, and we're now outside of my area of policy expertise, but one parallel that I don't know enough about to comment what the actual results are, you could look at initiatives in states, so states that let people vote directly on the law. Right? Obviously, it gives you more agency than you have in a state that doesn't. So what is the turnout in those states versus in the states that
And on this, do you mean just in Georgia, they're called ballot initiatives?
Yep. That's when you're voting directly for a law that either becomes part of the state constitution or just another law in the state, whatever you
And which are almost always phrased utterly duplicitously on
the ballot. Yeah, certainly.
I'm just going to go ahead and say,
I don't know if you
can tell which party framed the language,
right?
Because it'll be, you know, this initiative will give the people of Georgia the freedom to, and I'm like, I just stopped reading there. I'm like, okay, I know which party framed this one. But anyway, go ahead.
So yeah, just you could look and see if those bring more people out. Again, I don't know if they do or not. Sort of historical parallel, again, I'm not a scholar of this, so you'd have to go and talk to people who are, when women were given the right to vote nationally, right? What was the impact on overall turnout? Well, obviously there were going to be more people turning out and voting because they could vote
in raw numbers. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now I do know that in the immediate aftermath of that, there was functionally no change in the outcome of the elections. So
per capita, the same percentage.
Yeah. Now over time that has shifted, and there are partisan differences between women and men now that are talked about. The gender gap is a sort of common political science thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. Women tend to vote more for Democrats than they do for Republicans. That's a more modern phenomenon that was not originally the case. So there are things that you could look at, and I don't know enough about them to say more, other than there are things that you could make that parallel to and say, well, maybe X was the impact when we expanded how you vote and what you're voting for here. So maybe this would also be the impact in this other place. So listener, feel free to crunch the numbers on that.
In a system with lots of variables, it's hard to isolate them.
Right. Well, ask AI. It'll tell you.
Listeners, please don't ask AI. That's a rant that I'll spare our listeners today. Coyle, I mean, you know, those are the what if questions, the science fiction questions that I've got. I know that, you know, you've already tipped your hand a few times that, you know, you think that, you know, opening things up and making them closer to a plebiscite is probably a bad idea generally. What else do you have to say about it?
No, it's not. So that is entirely dependent on how you value the American citizen, right? If you think the American citizen is generally responsible and can generally make wise decisions, then yeah, it's of course it's a good thing, right? The more How do you generate responsibility? Well, you generate responsibility by giving someone responsibility and letting them practice at it. So there's sort of a trap there, right? You can't say, well, the American citizen is generally kind of dumb and lazy, so let's not give them this authority, when the way that you stop being dumb and lazy is you give them authority and you make them actually work at it. So,
right, yeah. Right.
I would not automatically be opposed to it, so long as we are very clear that what's coming along with this is responsibility, right? You're not just getting this thing.
Yeah,
you're also expected to use it well. That's the part where I think we sort of fall down. We tend to start with, well, it's our right to do this. We should be able to do this, and there is no responsibility attendant on that right. It's just a naked right. Well, I would say at that point, that's not the right attitude to have. If we're going to move in that direction, it should be, this is a heavy responsibility that we as citizens have not truly had to bear. So let's keep that in mind while we're thinking about this. But generally. I'm an electoral college guy. The electoral college, the Senate, and the Supreme Court are kind of the three bastions of federalism that are left. I'm going to be hesitant about getting rid of those. There are other things. So I'm also team filibuster, which is not constitutional, so it doesn't have quite the same punch.
Right.
But in anything that kind of makes us slow down and look at the country more broadly, I think I'm going to sort of default to. But I don't want to say there's not a legitimate argument on the other side. I don't want to say that.
Right.
There are well-intentioned people making good arguments that we should seriously consider. And honestly, I'd probably be willing to trade that. Like you vote for, I'll vote for this amendment if you vote for, I don't know, some other amendment I care about. I don't have anything in mind, but there's things that I'd bargain with on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you know what's interesting there, of course, is that trying to make a principled argument is just extraordinarily difficult because you know, as you and I have both noted multiple times. I mean, you know, when people articulate a principled argument, it always entirely coincidentally, I'm sure, happens to favor the party that, you know, the person favors. So, you know, I'm sure I'm fooling myself, and, you know, always beware the person says I'm sure I'm fooling myself, but, you know, I mean, I'd like to think because I have such a distaste for both major parties that, you know, I can at least, you know, articulate what would be a principled argument one way or the other. But, you know, as we've noted over and over, because the people who don't like either party are relatively rare, you know, those aren't the folks who are going to be swaying policy, much less, you know, constitutional law.
Well, and you have to have a party to sway policy. By definition, right?
That's Sanders and Trump have demonstrated these last 10 years.
Well, as No Labels has demonstrated, if you followed that movement. I mean, that movement that almost ran a presidential candidate and then didn't for reasons that they have been very quiet about. But I assume basically they couldn't find someone who wanted to do it. And I assume find someone who wanted to do it because if you win as a No Labels candidate, you're not going to get anything done whatsoever because who's going to work with you? So.
Right. That's depressing. But, well, Coyle, I mean, anything else that you want to put in there? I mean, you know, these, speculative fiction episodes, you know, tend to be short ones, but I don't want to cut it off too short before
it's okay.
I
don't have a final word on this. I think we probably talked about the Electoral College already on here. So, no, I don't have anything to add. It's, like I said, I'm generally team Electoral College, but that doesn't mean the arguments on the other side are bad. So
very good. Well, listeners, you know, the third in the, What If series, which might be the next episode or might not be, I haven't even looked to see, you know, where it would fall, you know, relative to the DNC this year, which we're going to do an episode on, is going to be, what if a president ran on and won an election on a limit the powers of the president platform? This might be the most science fiction of the three, I realize, but I love these science fiction kinds of questions, so that'll be the third one. In the meantime, you know, look forward to our examination of the Democratic National Convention. We're going to be doing that soon. And, of course, between now and November, as things unfold, as we find out who in fact is running for president this year, which is not usually something I'm saying in late July. You know, we'll have an episode. We'll have episodes in the plural talking about that. But thank you for listening.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at Facebook.com/City of Man Podcast, or get in touch with us at CityofManPodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.